This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It's a good show.
Welcome to Your Making It Worse. We're here, we're queer, who cares? I'm Elliot Glazer.
And I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott.
Textual healing.
Grease lightning.
Waka waka.
Who does that make you think of?
What?
Grease lightning. Grease.
I don't know.
Grease.
John Travolta.
John Travolta.
I've never seen Grease.
You've never seen Grease?
No, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah. Okay. So John Travolta obviously was the star of Grease. I've been obsessed with John Travolta for a very long time.
But not for positive reasons.
Not for positive reasons. No. I find him to be a very fascinating human being. And Kirstie Alley was asked in an interview if she thought John Travolta is gay.
Yeah.
And John Travolta has publicly said he's not gay.
But rumors for over a decade.
Yes. So I'll get into that. So what Kirstie said was, no, I don't think he's gay. I mean, I know him pretty well. And she refers to the idea that they didn't have a sexual relationship, but that they had an emotional relationship, which she said was worse than actually cheating on her husband. And then when she was asked why a relationship between Kirstie and John would never work, she said, well, I go to bed at 9 o'clock at night and wake up at 5 a.m. So we basically wouldn't have seen each other. It would have been a disaster. But we're still friends after all these years. Now, this answer to me is so bizarre because it's like, that's not the it's not about your sleep schedule. Like, John Travolta is the strangest person. He's a Scientologist, a devout Scientologist who is, in my opinion, is so openly gay that it's almost like he's trolling us. And the rumors that you talk about
say he's so openly gay.
Well, let me explain. Yeah. The rumors that you're talking about have persisted for way over 10 years.
Yeah.
This guy has been seen in so many bathhouses.
Uh-huh.
He allegedly was paid.
Let's talk about verifiable things. There was a lawsuit that was settled.
Yeah. He's been seen in many bathhouses. There's an incredible photo of him kissing the male nanny on the tarmac of his jet, to which he said, we're best friends. Best friends kiss on the lips. There's recently a bunch of photos of him at gyms where he was doing a workout at 3 a.m.
He goes to the gym at very early in the morning
and takes photos.
He will chat.
Yes.
He'll chat up objectively super hot guys. And then there was one famous one many years ago where the guy's like, hey, can I get a picture with you? And I think the guy initiated it. And John's like, sure. And then the guy posted on Instagram. He's like, oh, I got – John Travolta just approached me at 3
the gym,
in the morning
at the, 3
at
in
the
gym.
Morning.
Also, I found some incredible photos of him flying in to the Australian Open to pose with the Socceroos. He's obsessed with the Socceroos, this Australian soccer team.
Uh-huh.
He is so strange to me, and I feel like he does exude a lot of open gay behaviors.
Yeah, the kissing on the tarmac and the gym selfie would certainly be suspect.
And of course, there were, so many allegations by masseuses who have said...
Right. Well, see, and that's the part that I'll be honest, and this is a bit of a Debbie Downer moment, but I think a lot of this... Well, and you've said it too. I mean, the only reason why you're as obsessed with John Travolta possibly being gay is because you don't like John Travolta, whereas we've had open conversations before about this obsessive need gay men specifically have in wanting to make everybody gay.
Okay, so
and,
sure. Yes,
but wait,
yes,
wait, wait,
yes,
wait
sorry,
let me finish.
Sorry.
Let me finish.
You're right.
So there's this obsessive need, and the talk of things that don't really matter, like... I saw so-and-so in a bathhouse, or he takes pictures at the gym at 3 a.m. Those are not fucking gay reasons. Now, what is an open conversation that should be had is when a person, male or female, has a million-dollar lawsuit against someone for sexual harassment. That is a conversation to have. That's something to discuss.
Which he's
that
had?
Then, well, he obviously
the masseuse
settled it. The masseuse, he settled it.
Yeah,
and
he settled a few of them.
That's a conversation where then the gay conversation comes in. But all of these other things, I find it tacky, frivolous, and dumb. Honestly,
I hear you. I think it builds a narrative that's kind of funny. I think the gym selfie thing is ridiculous. That he's like chatting up, like literally. If you just Google John Travolta gym selfie, you'll see a picture of John Travolta with a model hot guy.
Yeah,
and I agree, but I think it's hilarious.
And to your point, I don't like the obsessive nature by gay guys. I actually hate when gay guys are like, Jake Gyllenhaal's gay, this one's gay. I'm like,
she fucked my friend.
I do find that frivolous.
Bob Vila's gay.
With John Travolta, the thing that irks me and has always irked me is that it's almost as if he's protesting so much that at the same time it is like a level of trolling where, as I was saying to you the other day, when he would go on Oprah, I remember this so distinctly, when he would go on Oprah in like the mid-90s and dance with Oprah and let her, oh, he's so sexy, the audience is screaming, and his wife comes out, Kelly Preston, and they say, oh, we have so much sex, we're always fucking. It's like, what? And then he'd come out and speak so defensive. Carrie Fisher literally wrote in Out magazine, we don't care that John Travolta's gay. I mean, she told The Advocate, I mean, my feeling about John has always been that we know and we don't care. Look, I'm sorry that he's uncomfortable with it, and that's all I can say. It only draws more attention to it when you make that kind of legal fuss. So to me, it's this bizarre need to be like, I'm not. Settle lawsuits, tell publications, tell the media, I'm not gay. And then the weirdest shit, above everything else, above the fact that he like is a Scientologist and like lives in the skies or whatever and like flies his own planes and makes the weirdest music videos and has hair pieces but pretends he's not balding, above all that is the weird dark truth that he denied his kid medication for seizures because he's a Scientologist, and that kid hit his head in the shower and died. And that is so sad and so tragic. And watching that unfurl is like so painful. And then to watch the repercussions of that be they had another baby. Yeah. And she's like 50. And it's just this bizarre like patching that I think is probably based in Scientology and maybe being blackmailed in some capacity there.
We're all over the board right now.
But I get it.
I get what you're saying, but I also think
I also think when
you perpetuate conversations like that in sort of really non-verifiable, catty ways, the masseuse, that's a conversation. The child thing, that's a conversation. But the whole, like, kissing on the tarmac, you know, the soccer team, the gym workout, all that shit, it's the same shit that basically is just – it's almost a game conversation. It's like it's not real. It's just
so dumb.
How about
this? Let me tell you about how I met him in high school. He came to Borders in downtown Ann Arbor to do a book signing right around the time Battlefield Earth, the worst movie of all time, came out.
Oh, yes, that is the worst.
So I waited in line with my friends for two or three hours to meet him, and I had a really bad pimple on my nose, so I popped it. But it was just repellent. So I covered it with a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
But, you know, not a whole Band-Aid. Just like, you know, just the part that blends into your skin.
Yeah, sure.
But that started to fall off because just like my skin. So
is this a real story?
I swear to God. I covered the Band-Aid with more tape. So I met John Travolta with a Band-Aid and tape over my nose. And I remember the first thing I said, I just walked right up to him. I was like, just so you know, here's what happened. I had a pimple.
God.
I had to cover with a Band-Aid. And now I got some tape over the – and I just remember he was like, okay, cool.
Wow.
He signed my book.
I met him once too. A couple years ago when I was working for AIDS Walk at the AIDS Project Los Angeles fundraiser
I'm not laughing at that. I'll –
He's not laughing at AIDS. He's unhinged. Yeah. He can't control himself. And I gotta say, he and Kelly were very, very nice and good to work.
I'm sure they're nice.
But my point is that, like, I get that it's fun to, like, do this. But at the same time, I'm also like, does it do us as a community any good to have these kind of conversations?
I'm the one that's
I don't think he owes us anything to come out. I don't care when celebrities don't come out, especially old school famous people.
But it's then it becomes a farce to watch him. I mean, Alan,
but why does
Alan, what is funnier than seeing him on the finale season of Oprah getting out of an airplane and saluting Oprah as the audience screams for it, like,
I know,
what
but
are
at the
you?
Same time, you're
what are you doing?
Let's say that he is gay, right?
Yeah.
And for whatever reasons, because of his religion, because of his background, because of who he is, he can't come out of the closet. So then what you're doing, even though, yes, he's a very powerful man and he's doing lots of things to cover it up.
Yes.
What you're doing then is saying we're essentially like poking fun at a person who is unable to come out because of his religion,
which is okay. But then why would you speak so poorly about gay people as if it's nonsense?
He doesn't speak poorly about gay people. That's the thing. He does the opposite.
He's so dismissive.
No. He goes to fucking fundraisers supporting gay people.
No, he doesn't.
AIDS fundraisers supports gay people.
Okay, did he go in drag?
He did in a movie.
Terrifying. That was a terrifying character in a terrifying movie. And I will end on saying,
has he ever said anything anti-gay?
I don't know. I will end on saying this. You guys need to watch the movie Old Dogs.
Okay.
Listen.
I don't think I will. Yeah.
Please.
I'm a hard pass already.
Listen to me. Let me just explain very quickly. It is the strangest movie that somehow got made. It was supposed to be an R-rated movie, like a dirty movie of some kind. And Robin Williams and John Travolta somehow signed on to a movie that became a G-rated movie. And the entire movie is literally like you're on a drug trip. It is the strangest thing. And John Travolta's hair changes several times during the movie.
Wow.
Also, Adele Dazeem. I mean,
please welcome the wickedly talented one and only Adele Dazeem.
Not even joking.
Matt Dempsey.
Yes.
I'm not using the formal Matthew.
Matthew Dempsey.
Matt, you are a therapist and social... Sorry. I should know this before we...
Yeah. No, not social worker, but a psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist.
Which is just kind of like the umbrella term for anybody that does talk therapy. Mm-hmm. So like kind of more officially, I'm a clinical counselor.
Got it.
So you're a counselor, but you don't prescribe drugs.
Exactly. Right. That's
then I don't need you. So
you do cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yes.
Which I've done.
CBT.
CBD.
Yes.
CBT.
For those in the know.
Yes. Eclectic. So wait, what's eclectic, humanistic, interpersonal, psychodynamic, and schema?
Yeah.
Eclectic and humanistic?
You're totally pulling this off of Psychology Today, aren't you?
Yes.
It's one of those things that as a professional, when you sign up for it, that you have to just kind of click off all the ones that apply.
Of course.
So most of this stuff kind of relates. Eclectic is the most kind of umbrella term because it just means kind of all of it. You kind of dabble in all of it, but mainly... and my training was kind of dominated by something called multiculturalism.
Oh, wow.
And so that perspective in therapy just takes into account the, like, variety of cultural identities that we have, both kind of like, you know, the ones of privilege, also the ones that are marginalized, and kind of how they all interplay with each other to create just our self-concept, like how we feel about ourselves and then how we move through the world.
Wow.
Interesting.
That is fascinating.
I'm more of a Carl Rogers humanist type myself, but
so you're a kind heart.
I'm an empathetic soul.
Oh, that's a good start.
You also kind of, you know, you take your work and you put it out onto social media.
I do.
And there's a lot with YouTube videos, and you do a lot of sort of, how would you describe sort of your social presence?
I guess probably I'm, you know, kind of on YouTube. I just put out, I guess, these think pieces, just kind of whatever's on the top of my head, something that I think is interesting, something that I think maybe hasn't been tackled.
Hot Cheeto test.
The different kinds of boogers, right? This is like,
it's experiential. But yeah, and so I just kind of tackle that and hopefully, you know, kind of people are interested in it or resonate with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think especially for, you know, because I mainly speak to things that are relevant for gay men. So it's obviously a very niche thing.
Yeah.
But
so using as many names as possible, what what would you say? Are there like common themes you hear a lot?
From gay guys.
Yeah.
From gay men or
or lesbian? True. Tease.
I would say kind of a couple things. Like, just the, kind of the most general stuff that comes up are just how difficult it was growing up and some of the difficulties in knowing how to connect. And then when finally coming out, this idea that you're going to be able to connect with, like, your tribe, and then you go out there and you're like, what the fuck? Nobody's connecting at all.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody's an asshole to each other.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That, and then also, you know, kind of stemming from that, just, you know, fear of connecting, opening up, being intimate, knowing how to do that in, like, a community that can be kind of harsh.
Check,
with
check,
each other.
Check.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair
so
enough.
You're describing Brent Sullivan.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, it's so interesting to hear, because I'm in therapy. I love therapy.
Oh, cool.
My therapist is gay. I've been doing therapy for years.
Nice.
And he, I don't think he specifies in just a gay male clientele, but
sure.
certainly has, I'm sure, I know that obviously as a gay man, he, you know, is a, I couldn't see a therapist who wasn't gay.
Right.
I tried.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind those therapists.
I like looking at their eyes when you talk about
certain
things.
Actually, I don't like
yes,
a
and
gay
Brent
therapist.
Doesn't like to see a gay therapist.
Oh.
I will trust say, issues with gay people.
And I
Brent's therapy.
I couldn't see a non-gay therapist because there is an element there of feeling the desire to be understood in a way that doesn't
totally.
Require explanation.
Yeah.
Or and in Brent's case, I understand, like, I would actually feel afraid of judgment. I know it's unethical, but afraid of some type of even the most minor judgment.
I don't think it is.
From a therapist who wasn't gay or understood the experience.
That's not an unheard of thing. I mean, queer people have been dealing – they're still dealing with medical professionals who treat them or treat the questions they ask. And I mean, even with just PrEP, just a couple years ago, you ask your general practitioner about PrEP and they had varied opinions on
totally.
The use of PrEP and who would actually
sure.
go with PrEP. So and now
PrEP
it's become
being a drug that
HIV prevention medication.
Right.
And
right.
and it's you know, I mean, it's become that's not an unheard of thing.
Yeah.
And so I don't – yeah, I have to have female therapists. So I have a therapist and a psychiatrist, and, like, I've always felt more comfortable with women.
Yeah, I've heard this kind of on both sides about how you know, a lot of people feel more comfortable with guy therapists because you just kind of get it.
Yeah.
And then also the flip of that, too, is, oh, God, I'm afraid you're just another gay guy who's judging me, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of don't feel comfortable. I'm more comfortable with, you know, women.
And,
whatever.
I mean, that last point I think is really interesting coming from a professional.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you – tackle that.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I was going to say, like, without giving away all your secrets or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, what, how the fuck do you survive? How the fuck are we supposed to survive?
What?
That is a big question.
No,
in what sense? Like, the apocalypse?
When it comes, in a general sense, when it comes to treating gay male clientele, like,
right.
is
you have,
there...
Well, okay, let me phrase it in a form of a question. how do you deal with gay male clients who perhaps have a fear of judgment from another gay man who,
yes.
perception-wise, looks and acts and is very much a part of maybe a WeHo establishment or a type of gay man that we feel – some people feel, we in general, but also in outside the world, feel persecuted or judged by?
Totally. I mean, that's kind of a tall order. There's no way that I could ever rid anybody of feeling uncomfortable in a situation. And so I really kind of release the need to try and do all of that as much as I can. Just check my own shit, check my own judgments, check my own kind of what's called countertransference that can happen in therapy, and just make sure that like I can show up in the most loving, you know, kind of open, non-judgmental way that I can. And hopefully that's going to be communicated. And I find kind of most of the time it is because it's sincere.
Yeah.
But again, you can't ever control for that.
What's countertransference?
So in therapy, the thing when you're a client and you go in and you work with a therapist, you know how sometimes you kind of like you have certain feelings about this person. Like somebody will come in and look at me and think, oh, there's just another WeHo queen. That's transference. It means, you know, kind of the experiences that I've had outside of therapy, I'm now transferring onto this person based off of very little information and, you know, kind of seems like that this is who you are, and now I have feelings about that.
Huh, interesting.
So countertransference then is just the reverse, what happens with a therapist with a client.
So, I mean, speaking on that, like, that's an interesting thing because, like, you look at, you know, we all have our judgments about people and how we work and how we interact with people.
Not me.
And...
I'm perfect. me, I'm perfect.
No, but you look at people and the way they act, the way they talk, or the way they present themselves online, and you make a judgment based on past experience.
Of course.
So it's just I think, a natural thing. And, I mean, for you as a professional, people, gay men specifically, coming to you and looking at sort of, you know, your social media platforms and sort of the mental health work that you do put out online – And then looking, you know, over the course of sort of like the shirtless photo shoot that you did, or, you know, certain videos on YouTube or whatever. And then they transfer those past judgments onto you about what they've received outside the gay community and from the gay community. How do you address that? And do you feel in some way that there's a responsibility you have as a mental health professional in sort of what you put out there with treating these patients?
Absolutely. So I guess just to answer that first question of, you know, do I feel like a responsibility? I do feel a responsibility to make sure that I'm kind of representing myself and my intentions in the most authentic way that I can. Kind of how that translates is really just kind of up to me. Like, there's not necessarily kind of an ethical standard or guideline specifically about that. Like, you know, you shouldn't post shirtless pictures, let's say, because that's obviously
it was
what
a delightful picture.
Thank you so much.
Very good.
Well, it's interesting because I was looking for a therapist a few years back, and when I was starting the process, I was, for the first time, I was like, I'm going to go to a gay therapist. And it was interesting how I would – you find these websites that people advertise – the therapists advertise themselves. And there were some people, therapists, who had headshots that were kind of sleazy. And, wow. And I was I couldn't help but
– Wait, what do you mean sleazy?
It's like
– cheesy,
like,
or frosty, sleazy?
Almost like – it was like a glamour shot. Remember glamour shots?
Yeah.
And there were – I mean, therapists, especially in L.A., maybe this is the case everywhere, but like therapists have pictures of themselves in L.A. So
and, like,
I
headshots.
They have headshots. Yeah. I mean, of course, everyone in L.A. has a headshot.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the fact that the picture existed. I was also incredibly sensitive to, could I find them on social media and what was their presence like? And I got instantly weirded out if it was like – if it was anything but this sort of – classic, like, I wanted to see a professor with a pipe.
Totally.
On a leather chair, which is, I think, an unfair judgment, but I couldn't help but feel that way.
Yeah, it's. I don't think that's an unfair judgment because, you know, you're wanting to go to somebody that you feel like is going to be, like, almost paternal, that you could go to, you could look up to, that kind of, like,
would
it, you know,
never
hold them to a certain standard.
Yeah, would never even consider you sexual under any circumstances.
Right. Well, it's interesting you say that. So I'm on Grindr.
Yeah.
And I'm also pretty kind of open about that. Like, I've got that picture, like that shirtless picture of me with my face, like, in there. And I'm very open because that's what I try to promote, is not having shame around sex, not having shame around, you know, kind of an openness in that way. And so I kind of put myself out there like that. And I recently just had somebody message me where it was like kind of just a body shot. They were fully clothed. And also in the bio, it said like mask and musk only.
Yeah.
And then
he's like, I'll see you on Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he messaged me
and says,
I just want to let you know I'm another therapist in town. And I find it fascinating that you've put yourself out there in such the way that you do, so candid. And though I think that we should be able to have a right to our sexuality, haven't you thought about the disadvantages of this and the kind of transference issues that your clients would have?
Yeah.
You know, I've known therapists where this has been damaging to their practice and blah, 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 blah. And I've seen clients that didn't want to come to you because of this.
Yeah.
And, of course, my shit gets stirred up, and I'm just like, this queen is coming for me on Grindr.
Yeah, sure.
I need to get ready for clients right now.
How does that make you feel?
Like, well, that made me feel it, like, because I have my own fears. Like, am I doing things for the wrong reason? Is this not okay? Is this damaging, or is this making other people feel a certain kind of way? So those are normal fears to have, and so my shit got stirred up. But I also know how to, like, temper that and not react to it. So I gave, I, like, took a beat, and a couple hours later I went back and I was going to try and, like, engage, and he had already blocked me.
Wow.
Yeah.
I saw my therapist on Scruff years ago.
Yeah.
And but I would say if I saw him shirtless, I think it would have weirded me out.
Sure. I totally get that.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
No, he was, like, clothed, and I was like, okay. I mean, I blocked him immediately.
Button because
I
don't. Pipe?
Yeah. Smoking a pipe on a couch. But I do. I mean, I think. I don't know. I mean, I think it. I don't know where the line is blurred. But it, like, I would be freaked out if I saw my therapist, like, shirtless. I think because I was going to say, because for me, I think there's a line between, like, you being authentically you, but then also this, like, fitting into this, like, sexual grid.
Right.
Yeah. And this is just me, but I wouldn't want to see my therapist in a sexual capacity.
Sure.
Because I want it to be this, like, sexless, you know, this like
totally
clean relationship with parameters where there's none of that there.
Yeah.
And I think and that for me is just where I would see it and be like, I can't.
Yeah, I get it.
And I blocked it and I had to block him with
just his face.
Yes.
With just the pipe.
Yes.
I think there's I had a thought that it's like I've heard of stories before of like kindergarten this is a big example. This is big. A kindergarten teacher who made porn in the past.
Mm, yeah.
So it's someone who has, first of all, the right to do whatever they want.
Brent taught kindergarten, just so you
guys know. Yeah, I taught kindergarten. Someone who has the right to do whatever they want with their body. Someone who is in a sensitive position that is unaffiliated with their porn past. But there's a world in which I could see parents being not comfortable with a former porn star teaching their kids kindergarten. But I think in those instances, I've always agreed that that's that person's right to be a porn star in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because you're a therapist.
Matthew's
mental,
not a porn star.
Matt's not a porn star. But just because you're a therapist doesn't mean you shouldn't be allowed to be shirtless whenever you want. You
right.
know?
I mean, I think there's a difference, though. And this is something, and I want to get to your Pretty Privileged video because it sort of ties into that. So, like, I'll be honest. I think I saw the Pretty Privileged video, like, because it kind of did some rounds. It like went viral or something. I hate that word.
It went. It was like a gay. It was like
there were articles on it and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I didn't know you. I know you now. Very nice. But when I saw initially, I was like, this douche. Like, I mean, just
that's what I said in the video.
And let me, explain it. So right. like, okay. so I know you said that in the video, and I watched it again last night. So the video is just essentially you describing sort of, I mean, Pretty Privileged. It pretty much speaks for itself that there's a certain advantage based on the genetics that you said it yourself, genetic lottery. You won the genetic lottery that you have from societal, both in terms of employment and sex and life and general access to things.
Mm-hmm.
If you look a certain way, just like white privilege, if you look a certain way, you get certain things. And I get the concept of it and I understand it. And watching it again last night and talking with my boyfriend more about it, it sort of even helped me not think of you as a douche, which I love because you're not a douche.
But
I also want to be honest because I'm sure a lot of listeners probably saw it, didn't watch it, and was like, this douchebag.
Right.
And so I'm probably like a lot of people who thought you were a douchebag.
Yes.
And guys, he's not a douchebag.
Thank
he
you.
Has great hair. But that said, I do take – there's something about it that I find arrogant.
Yes.
And not in the sense of, you know – I don't think you're arrogant. What I'm saying is, like, there's a difference between white privilege because you can't control your race.
Sure.
You were born a certain way. Pretty is so subjective that, you know, who thinks you're attractive is very different from who thinks Elliot thinks attractive.
Oh, or
who,
how dare you?
You know what, Alan?
You
how
dare you?
But you know what I'm saying.
And so, like, there is a level of arrogance even in talking about pretty privilege that then by you saying that and applying it to yourself, I then think – this is just another way. This is essentially the same thing as a shirtless picture on Instagram. It's a thoughty picture. It's a way to separate yourself from everybody else and stop a conversation. And I wanted to ask you about that and sort of what you thought about that and more of your intention behind that video.
Yeah. Oh, my God. This was a video, actually, that I wanted to do probably for about 7 years when I saw Cybill Shepherd on Oprah's final farewell season.
That just made me love you.
So I saw that episode, and I remember hearing Oprah talk about it. Kind of, it was in, like, her life class, like, the following year or whatever.
Yeah.
And she just said that in the 25 years that she did this show, she never, ever had one person come on who was a model or, like, an attractive celebrity or anything like that that would actually own up to the fact that they had this advantage.
I've had a few awkward moments physically growing up myself, but overall I was kind of a cute kid and a good-looking young person. But I remember there was this one time when I was about 12 years old feeling particularly awkward with glasses and braces, and I was in the car with my friend's grandma, and I said to her one day, we were like chatting it up as any good young gay boy would do with an older woman. We're chatting it up, and I just said to her, you know, I'm going to get my glasses off, I'm going to get my braces off, and then I'm going to be cute, and then people are going to want to talk to me more. And she just looked at me and said, oh, honey, you are already so cute and so handsome with the glasses and braces. And there was just something about the way that she said it that legitimately felt sincere. Like, I didn't think she was giving me lip service. And I believed it, and it reassured me, and it calmed me down. And that's actually kind of been, overall, the experience in my life, the kind of feedback that I've gotten, you know? And so the experience that I've had then is one of pretty privilege.
You know, anytime she would ask it, they would always skirt it and kind of play the modesty card. And Oprah's like, modesty's not real. So, okay, we're not having an honest conversation. Except when Cybill Shepherd came on, she went in.
Of
and
course
she was
did.
Just.
Who,
yeah.
Oprah went in?
No, Cybill Shepherd. Yeah, Oprah just like asked her questions and she, because it was about aging. And she said, oh my God, yeah, it's like really difficult aging, da da da. She became jealous of her own daughter walking down the street, getting more attention than she would. And, you know, she had become, like, she was kind of born into it. She's talking about her own genetic lottery, right? Like, she didn't earn it. It was just a thing that happened for her, and it opened all of these doors. And Oprah was like, thank God, finally someone answered honestly. So when I saw that, I remember being like, oh, Oprah likes it, I can do it. And so
I think the same things often.
Yeah, he does. He definitely does. Yeah.
But so it was just kind of on the back burner. And at the time, I remember thinking, like, I don't even know how the fuck I'm supposed to do this right now, because I didn't feel totally equipped to have that conversation. But years after, I just kind of was re-inspired by it and thought, like, you know what, I think I can do this. Mm-hmm. So I did it. But the one thing that I wanted to do differently than I've ever heard it done before, I kind of like say this a little bit in the video, is Cybill Shepherd was fantastic. She was totally honest. She went right in. She was also
fantastic.
Speaking from a place where she's kind of like now like beyond the privilege because of aging. And anybody else, you know, who's kind of talked about it has had some kind of caveat. And so I think this is the part where it can definitely come across as arrogant, because I didn't go in any other way to talk about my own insecurities or like things that I struggle with, because I didn't want to condescend. I just wanted to say, like, look, here's the privilege. Mm-hmm. This is what it is. These have been the advantages for me, and this is how I think it's problematic when we're not having a more honest conversation about the fact that this is a fucking thing, and especially somebody speaking from a place of privilege.
And so, what I mean, I hear that completely, and I think acknowledging it is one thing, but then talking about ways in which you incorporate tackling it in your everyday life, and that's something that I think
tackling what in my everyday life
in terms of like. Are you using your pretty privilege and just maintaining the status quo of being friends with the same type of people who are also pretty and going to the same things with just the pretty people? And it's like the, you know, are you just maintaining that status quo and just talking about it to talk about it? Or are you living it actively to tackle it?
Totally. So I did put a lot of thought into how I was going to even tackle this conversation to put it out there. And I decided against talking about, you know, kind of like the specifics of what I do, the kind of more prescriptive part of it.
Yeah.
I guess just because I kind of didn't want to kind of like go into like, and this is what you should do, right?
Exactly.
It's like, okay, this guy's going to fucking tell us this now.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to do that. So it was a fine line. And
but what do you do?
What do I do in real life? To tackle.
I think that's sort of.
Like how am I broadening definition of beauty standards?
When I watched it initially and I, at first, that's what I was craving the answer from you. Like, acknowledging you have pretty privilege is one thing. Acknowledging that you're not just living off of this pretty privilege and you're actively sort of incorporating different types of people into your life, and you're not viewing people and dating people in the same way and acting and treating people in the same way. Like, how can pretty people, if you will, not live off pretty privilege?
I think it's really enticing that if you're kind of like, if you're somebody who benefits from this pretty privilege, that you're going to just want to keep like hoarding as many kind of like, you know, like Insta people.
Because you see that all the time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I don't think I do that. And I think I'm kind of really intentional about the kinds of people that I want to surround myself with. Mm-hmm. And their appearance isn't a part of that for me.
Yeah.
So
you did pass my douchebag test.
It's hard.
I did.
Remember that I've talked about in this podcast before, the douchebag Instagram test, where you look at someone's Instagram and if the first sort of 9 photos, I guess 3, 3, 6, 9, the first 9 photos is all shirtless, all selfie, and all men, and they all look the same, they're a douchebag. And you don't have that. You have thoughtful things, words. You have women. You have different types of people. It's wonderful.
I always say you can also play the game of. Does this person know a woman? You just look for a single woman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I do think it's hard because I think we don't talk about it a lot, but the way we make friends and the people we make friends with, I think most often
aligns with how much money we make and how we look.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most
consistent.
Like, if you go to a bar, I think so. I think it's very consistent when you see
even
people
not
in groups.
Even not knowingly, you're saying,
absolutely.
Without intention.
By the way, ask every straight guy you know, you know, like kind of a macho straight guy, be like, who do you find good looking? And they'll be like, oh, man, I don't think guys are good looking. I couldn't tell you. And then you say, well, why are all of your friends like this same level of good looking as you? Why are your friends like... Because I've had coworkers who are like really handsome people, and I've seen their friends, and they'll be like, oh, I don't know if that guy's good looking. Oh, that's interesting, because every one of your friends is as good looking as you are. And I think we naturally gravitate to these people that kind of look like us, whether we consciously acknowledge it or not.
I don't know. I mean, for me, it's like when you talk about something like having the privilege of like being attractive, it's so like it's such a like specific talking point mm-hmm. For the reason that I think it could be problematic is because, and I'm sure you speak to this all the time, but like gay male culture, mm-hmm. especially in a place like LA, is so
toxic.
It feels so looks based in a way that when I stop and think about it, I'm like, I don't imagine that this echo chamber that is LA and mm-hmm. WeHo, especially for gay guys, mm-hmm. is the same thing in Akron and the same thing in Kennebunkport, or you know, and so
not
I'm like,
seen in Kennebunkport, Maine, not a huge scene there, but
it's
sure.
just like, it's just so. I mean, that's where I'm like, I don't know. I think that might be the problematic part of it for me, where it's like, it feels so, to me, it feels like not realistic because pretty privilege exists, but it's like, it feels like a sensitive thing to talk about when it's like everyone, especially as gay guys, are trying mm-hmm. to keep up mm-hmm. some semblance of looking a certain way.
Right.
And it becomes too difficult to parse it out as privilege versus not privilege.
Sure. No, I totally understand that, you know, and, you know, obviously if, you know, beauty standards are hopefully, you know, continue to be broad and continue to expand, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, you kind of can't deny the fact that there is this kind of like one standard, this kind of like much narrower version of mm-hmm. what typically society has deemed like the gold standard. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's my therapist puts it as saying that it's like it's a Nordic quality. Mm-hmm. There's a overarching, an overarching and mass need for consumption of a Nordic features, mm-hmm. tall, Caucasian, mm-hmm. like certain, mm-hmm. you know, like light features. Like it is a real thing, but most people don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
I think
even though that is like Instagram is definitely a source for a lot of this aesthetic based sort of level you're supposed to meet, and, mm-hmm. and it's becoming that, it's fueling that. But also, I think what you're doing in terms of putting out the conversation on mm-hmm. just sort of mental health awareness amongst gay men, and let's be real, like gay men suicide rates in this country are not great. Mm-hmm. Like it's needed right now to be able to talk about these issues, any issues, and pretty privilege, depression, how we feel sexually, how we feel about ourselves. It's really important. But also, too, you have shows like RuPaul's Drag Race that are showing that, you know, drag queens aren't out of drag always the prettiest mm-hmm. people, but you have these sort of like super hot dudes who are in Speedos loving on these drag queens. And on some capacity, seeing that in the world, I think, is bringing different types of people together mm-hmm. and maybe breaking down barriers of like
totally.
This Nordic quality that's the standard isn't necessarily the standard anymore.
No, but it... I mean, I think it still remains across the board with straight people too.
Yeah, of course,
it remains the standard.
Yeah,
and I think it's. I hope that we can just keep like disseminating totally. Rather than hyper focusing.
Yeah, I would say the one thing, like if I could go back and redo that video, because it's, you know, I have to be aware of the fact that that there was a lot of people that didn't connect with the video.
Yeah,
and that's unfortunate because, you know, obviously I'm just trying to put a message out there, and so if it's kind of not working exactly as I thought, I have to consider, okay, what could I have done differently? And I think probably the one thing is that prescriptive part. You know, it's not just kind of saying like, this has been my experience and whatever, but also like you were asking about, like, what do you do with that then?
Yeah.
You know, how can you actually find some way to help kind of broaden the scope and kind of
change the narrative a little bit? But I will say I was the douchebag in that situation because I literally just read you from not only the way you look, you're a very handsome man, great hair, like I said, but I immediately read like, this douchebag talking about pretty privilege talking to me, I got curves, I'm great. And I immediately read into that, and then I looked at your Instagram and was like, nah, it seems interesting, but nah. And then now, meeting you, but also like just like even just last night looking more into your stuff, I think you're doing something really important, which is engaging gay men in a conversation about mental health. And well, so like, what do you hope that people get from your work and what you're doing?
I hope that people get not just from the stuff that I speak about, but also how I put myself out there, myself personally, is, you know, just how can you find ways to open yourself up more? How can you be more vulnerable? How can you try to tap into more of a sense of who you are authentically when you grew up in a world that told you that that was shit? And actually just lean into it even when it's uncomfortable, to open yourself up, knowing that we're in a community of a bunch of wounded other people. And so it's going to be difficult, but to do that and kind of like be the light, you know, kind of be the change you want to see even when it's not totally met in kind.
Totally.
I'm always, you know, just to a point you just made, maybe I'm naive and I feel like I get laughed at for this, but I always feel like I'm surprised when I'm met with or I encounter a nastiness or a hyper negativity and just like feelings that make me feel terrible about myself, when I'm like, I always am like, aren't we all coming from in some capacity? Didn't somebody at some point, even if you had the most privileged and progressive liberal background, like surely as a gay person, you must have felt some semblance of feeling like an outsider or feeling, you know, isolated from your community. So I'm always just kind of like, and I know it's very naive, very Pollyanna of me, but I'm like, why would you be so mean, or why would you be so thoughtless or inconsiderate or purposely mean to another one of your brethren? I never understand it.
Well, because it's especially with our brethren, because it's just this convenient mirror. And so if you're treating other people nasty, you can't even imagine what they're doing to themselves inside on a daily basis.
Well, but it's also, I mean,
that's crazy.
But I will say to that, even though people are treating other people in a nasty way, there's a lot of assholes out there. There's also sort of this frustration with, like, for example, the thing I posted or you posted, we both posted recently about Max Emerson, and he posted this, like, picture of him on Fire Island with his butt out on the dock, and then the whole, but it wasn't even like,
what about
like,
his hole?
Like, yeah, but the whole thing wasn't necessarily about like just a sexy picture for him to get, you know, vain likes. That would have been fine, whatever, take do that picture. But the caption was, getting ready to go support gay homeless youth.
Oh, right.
And it's like, this is fucking absurd that you're not even using your capital, your millions of followers, to take a picture of you at the event raising money to support gay homeless youth to not be homeless. Also, and instead you're doing it naked.
And to add to that point, by the way, in a visual and just in a purely visual surface level, it's like, do you think that gay homeless youth are looking for you on Instagram to feel inspiration? No, they see you on this. There's a disconnect.
Allow me to read my favorite Instagram post of the last 2 months. This guy who I follow posted a picture, and the caption says, the What Are You Reading Challenge. Post a pic of you nude with what you're currently reading. And the best part is, he's nude and he's covering his junk with a book, and you can't even read the title of the book.
The title of
it's too far away.
Well, and so, like, that person, this person, things like that. And then speaking of things like pretty privilege, it's like, these people are using pretty privilege in sort of a pseudo sort of cause capacity, when in reality it's just coming off as arrogance. So when you talk about nastiness, it's like, well, some of the nastiness comes from a place that maybe is a bit warranted, because they're frustrated that these are the people with millions of followers. Where's the black kid in Atlanta who does ball culture? Why doesn't that kid have fucking millions of followers for the amazing things he's doing? Oh, it's because he doesn't look like this white dude who has his ass out all the time. And so there's there's some warranted to the nastiness, I think. I don't know.
Well, I absolutely understand the frustration with that, because it's like, okay, this is also kind of what I've spoken about, which is that the privilege isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what are you doing with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so if you have any kind of privilege, whether it's being pretty, male, white, like whatever it is, you know, use it for something. And if you're only using it because you're just getting attention, so then that's ego serving. You're just serving yourself, as opposed to how can you find a way to, you know, be able to spread information or some kind of hope, inspiration, positivity, anything that could be useful for other people, that could be of service to other people.
You can read a book. You can't see the title of the book, but you can read a book.
I can't read the title. I don't know what book he's reading. But
even if Max was like going to like, you know, an obesity epidemic awareness fundraiser or whatever, and he sat naked in a picture next to me naked, like that, that would at least be relevant.
I get that now
because I'm obese. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so there's, okay.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
So as a therapist who has like a public persona, and you make videos and, you know, you get a lot of blowback for them too, you know. But with that all being said, do you find that there's more success or failure in terms of having a public persona as a therapist? Does it work in your favor? Do you feel like it works against you?
Does it bring you clientele?
Or how does that unfold?
It does bring me clientele. So it does kind of work for me. And of course, like, I'd be lying if I didn't say that there wasn't some part of just however people see me, kind of what I look like, and want to come in the door for that. Mm-hmm. Certainly not going to be enough to keep them in there, though. Yeah. But I also think, you know, obviously kind of how I put myself out there and the things that I talk about, there's also kind of like some substance to that too. So it helps to really demystify, especially when therapy can just be a scary thing. Who are you going in to see? What's it going to be like? So you kind of just automatically get a flavor of that. It helps just kind of break that
mystery down a little bit. No, I think that's really beneficial.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, there is a very funny visual in my head of like the old Jewish therapist that I've had doing the same video as you, being in the field, taking off his shirt.
Pretty privilege is a thing, you know?
Not being able to see into the camera. That's my favorite,
Estelle,
just imagining.
Bring me a cup. Pretty privilege.
I will, and we'll let you go in a second, but I should say that I went to a therapist, ironically, in New York because, you know, she was... my friend went first and was like, you have to go see this woman. She is the craziest character you'll ever encounter. And she was this...
All of her Yelp reviews are horrible.
Horrible.
Like she's averaging 1.5 stars on
Yelp. She is an incredible, incredible source of comedy. Yeah. She has, from what I remember, 4 offices in the same, like, 10-block radius in New York, which makes no sense. One's in a hotel, one's in an office building, and she literally is this tiny woman with very big Jewy hair.
I want to be her.
You don't, because she has a headpiece with, like, buttons on it and would, like...
Why does she have a headpiece on?
I don't know, because she's buzzing people into different buildings. She has a fax machine going. She has a copy machine. She has a chair. It was the most incredible thing. And she is so mean and berates her patients, which you can see in the Yelp reviews where she would talk. She told me that I should do a Yiddish, something Yiddish, where it was like,
oh,
what
my God.
She is baffling. And there are my friend and I. Could only see her for so long before being like, we need to go to normal people to get medication.
Yeah.
But
it's $150 a pop.
Oh,
yeah.
That's the thing. She takes insurance so much. She's a crook. And so she's playing the system where she's trying to get as many patients in as possible and that she can charge the health insurance companies the most. So much so that she has this very bizarre, like, everything is decorated like a bizarre Victorian Laura Ashley circus thing. And you'd go in the office and she would say, first she'd have to, as an initial patient, you'd fill out a pile of paperwork, all of which asked a lot of unsavory questions about your ethnicity. Because she wanted to be like, are you Jewish? She wants Jews.
Yeah.
And you'd pay her by putting your copay, whether it's a check or cash, in the tiniest of envelopes. What? The tiniest of envelopes. You'd squeeze it in.
Like a tip for a masseur.
Yes. And she would open these bizarre French doors, hand me, she would say, like, give me the money. But she didn't want you to talk about it. She'd be like, And then, as if she's above the financial element of it, she is incredible and has...
Well, it sounds healthy.
Oh, yeah. And she's released books. She would put books about movie characters.
I don't know. Who knows? This is way too much.
I'll send you guys on a Yelp thread.
I saw my therapist at the Korean spa. This is, he's an old therapist because he moved, but I saw my therapist at the Korean spa, Wee Spa here in L.A., and I think he was more uncomfortable than I was.
Well, because you're looking for you're naked.
But
Alan likes being naked.
I was naked. He was at a place that you're all supposed to be naked, and yet he was like awkwardly, like not communicating. But we were next to each other.
Isn't that a thing? You don't want to communicate.
Yeah,
with your
you can't. I mean, that is kind of an ethical.
If you're in the same situation,
it doesn't matter. It's an ethical concern because if you're my client and I see you out and I go up to you and say like, oh hey, if you happen to be with these guys and like who's that? Now you're put in this uncomfortable position if you're not even open about the fact that you're in therapy. Right. So I can't do that to you.
But
so
we
it's
both
entirely
were alone.
Up to you.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry, it's not the answer you wanted.
Right.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for
Appreciate
having me.
Very
thank you
much.
Much. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Matt. And another thing.
Pets. We love them. We have them.
That's a good Brent intro, Ellie. Pets. We love them. We have them. I actually don't have a pet.
Nope.
Well,
so I'm
you have
shut
a pet.
This down right
you have a pet
now.
In Michigan.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
You have a pet in Michigan.
Yeah, my parents have a – we have a Gordon Setter. My parents have had two Gordon Setters in my life. They are the absolute sweetest type breed of dog in the world. I give him literally thousands of mouth smoochies.
You have a very narrow love for very specific animals.
I get angry at a lot of dogs that I don't like.
Right.
I always make jokes about throwing Elliot's dog in the oven.
And my dog is wonderful.
Your dog is wonderful, and I very much.
Well, you aren't an animal person. I mean, you like call it it. Like you call my cat it.
And it like, does this.
And
it
what's
does
so interesting
that.
Is
you know,
that
it
like,
gets on my lap a lot, and I find that a little frustrating.
Exactly,
times,
because he knows you don't like animals. And as soon as a cat reads you don't like animals, the cat's like, well, I'm gonna get on you.
Yeah, I do. I'm very particular about the pets I like, and I have just this weird visceral reaction to dog barking, and like when dogs are barking. Even my own dog back in Michigan, I'm like, let's get it quiet as fast as possible.
That's how it is for me with babies crying.
Yeah.
I want to it's an inherently genetic thing, I think, that I just want to kill the baby.
Really?
See, now, I don't know if that's
crazy.
Genetic. I feel like it's very counter-evolutionary.
I'll say, I love all animals. Dog barking doesn't really bother me, nothing. Except last night,
For killing babies?
I am. Last night I did watch a coyote eat a raccoon.
Holy shit!
Wow.
In my back apartment parking lot,
which was
fascinating.
Yard? Wow!
And I was going to say yard. That was
ate
great.
It alive.
Ate it alive.
Holy shit!
By
the way,
the thing's just yelping and screaming.
You know what you forget? You know what you forget? Every animal in nature that doesn't die of a heart attack is eaten alive.
Yeah.
All animals are basically eaten alive.
Because
unless
a lot
they
of
die of old age, quote unquote.
That's
which
the
they
animal
don't.
Kingdom,
no.
right?
I mean, I love animals. I will say I did not always love animals. I was not always a huge animal person. It was during chemo. I was staying at my friend's house. I didn't have an animal then. And she had a dog and my
Virgil.
Other friends had a dog, Virgil and Chucho. Mm. And I didn't really care about animals. It just wasn't a thing because my family always had annoying animals, and so I just didn't give a fuck.
Sure.
And then during chemo, it's emotional for me, but there's like, I was always on the couch downstairs in the living room, and Virgil, who's the kindest, sweetest dog, the sweetest little dog, little Muppet dog, would sit at my end of my feet, and Chucho would sit right at my side on the ground. And whenever someone would come up to the couch, the dogs would get real agitated and they would try to like move around so that the person couldn't come towards the couch, sit on the couch, couldn't do anything on the couch. And in some weird way, it was like they knew something was up and they were surrounding me. And it was just so touching. And it made me just in love with animals. And now I have my cat Frasier, and I
love that. Pussy.
I love him. And Michael doesn't give a fuck about animals, but yet he loves Frasier. He's obsessed with Frasier, and Frasier likes him better than me now.
I love animals, and
you've got a great dog.
Got a great dog, and grew up with a great dog. And ultimately, I've tried to be a cat person, and I can't get into them. I do love Alan's cat. I love Frasier.
He's a dog, though.
But that's the thing. I only like cats when people are like, it's basically a dog. I like a cat that is, like, your cat is actually, like, sweet and plays around and is cute. Yeah. But I'm genuinely, as much as I get into the face of random dogs that I love, that I'm just like, oh, you're so cute, that I should be afraid of, I'm really, truly petrified that not Frasier, but most cats will look at me and I'll be petting them and they'll just claw my skin off.
Sure.
And I don't know if that's...
You can protect yourself.
I know, but I don't know. I don't know if that's a primitive thing. I'm so afraid of
cats. I love Elliot's primitive brain. It's the cats are going to kill me and I need to kill babies if they make noise.
Not kill, but just make it
quiet.
Animals
read that, though. Animals can tell if you're hesitant towards them and they read into it. And sometimes they read it as like... fear.
Yeah.
And they start becoming afraid of you. And that's part of the reason why I think they do that. I mean, my mom was always a big animal person. My mom always said, like, approach an animal like you would approach a human and shake their hand. Like, they're just approach an animal. If you're at ease, they'll be at ease. You're good. And if the dog comes at you, do the dog whisperer thing where you take your fists and you kind of just show who's boss.
I also always trust a pet who has a human name, because the owner shows that the owner takes it seriously and has an earnestness that is values their pet over like their reputation.
Mm. I'm also glad to hear that there's someone else who quotes the dog whisperer as much as my parents.
Wait, I have to also add this because it's one of my favorite things. Alan, you grew up with a dog named
Yeah, let me explain.
Yeah.
So my parents, my mom and my stepdad's name is Charlie, and we lived on a street in a very tiny house, and next door there was a dad named Charlie, a son named Charlie, and a dog named Charlie. And on the other side of the place, there was a dad named Charlie and a kid named Charlie. And so when my stepdad and my mom got the dog, well, first it was a cat, and then it became many animals, but... they got the cat. They named it Charlie just to sort of be in line with all the other Charlies. Yeah. But then they started...
That, to me, also already makes no sense.
It was a thing. There was, like, multiple names Charlie.
Makes
so
no
they kept
sense
it.
To me.
So then after that animal died, they named the next animal Charlie. And then after that animal
bizarre.
Died, they kept naming every preceding
so
animal Charlie
bizarre.
Until this last few years ago when the last Charlie died. And my mom was really upset, and she was like, I gotta get a new dog. I gotta need a new Charlie. And I'm like... For the love of God, please do not name the fucking dog Charlie. And I was like, why? So she gets this dog.
Think about all the names in the world. Yeah. There are
many
names.
It's like a
names.
Running joke.
It is kind of a running joke.
Yeah.
So, but with this dog, with this dog, he got a different name.
She decided that it was time to change things up.
Yes.
So the dog a different name than Charlie.
Wait.
So I know. I'm leaving it for you.
So she sees this dog, and she's like, that's our dog. That's our dog. And she named him our dog.
Oh, that's right.
Odie, our dog. That is the strangest.
She is the least creative human being in the world.
Funniest thing I've ever heard. A dog named Odie, our dog. Our dog. What?
Yeah.
Like, I've heard people name their dogs Feldman and, you know, Bicycle.
My friend Lori named her cat Hamburger. It was really cute.
I don't know. At a certain point, that becomes cloying to me.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, yeah, you're trying a little too hard.
I
want to
name my dog
cloying? Muffin?
Muffin.
Cloying.
Cloying.
Yeah. Muffins. I think muffins cute.
It's a podcast. Don't use words like that.
I would say muffins. I think when you add an S at the end, Peppers, I think, is a cute name. Muffins.
No, I like it clunky and weird.
Muffin.
I want to shout Muffin, and I want to see a sentient being turn its head at me.
What would your aunt say? Brent, what would your aunt say about something she heard on the podcast today?
Would you want to throw my dog into the oven, you son of a bitch?
My Aunt Joanne would say, I think you have pretty privilege.
My Aunt Anne would say, you know who's a douchebag? My neighbor. He still has not brought back my shovel.
Aww.
Always bitching about that neighbor.
Well, for this episode of the podcast, thanks for listening. I'm Elliot Glazer.
Brent Sullivan.
H. Allen Scott.
It's a good show.